my surprise that no one has yet chosen Psalm 23. And yet I think that most would consider Psalm 23 to be the most well-known and perhaps the favorite to the most people of all the Psalms in our Scriptures. So let's turn to Psalm 23. I'd like to read that together first. And we will have to tailor the teaching on the Psalm this morning to the time available to us. And I trust that it will not only whet our appetite, but feed our souls. Psalm 23, remembering that what we will call the superscription is part in the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew text of the Psalm, and its first verse, actually. Psalm 23, and I'm reading from the New International Version. A Psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for You are with me. Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. In teaching on Psalms, I not only want to teach about the particular Psalm we're looking at, but also give us some equipment, some tools, so that we are better equipped to approach Psalms and read them, so that our minds and our hearts are brought in tune with the psalmist, so that we really enrich our reading. It becomes more meaningful. I often wonder what people read when they read this psalm, if they don't understand the situation in which David was when he wrote it. It might just be a sappy little song to many. So there's three S's that we've got here that I've been sort of simply presenting to you as things to consider to bring your minds and your hearts into tune with the psalm and the psalmist. The superscription, the setting or the situation in which the person wrote, and thirdly, the structure. And we'll just go through those very quickly and get a look at what this psalm is about. As we know, the superscription is part of the psalm. And in this particular psalm, it simply says, a psalm of David. Some of the psalms don't have a superscription at all, so they're not very helpful in that particular S. Others are very detailed. For example, the superscription to Psalm 51 is extremely detailed in the situation that that psalm was written in, or the history of David, which was the watershed for that cry of repentance. But a psalm of David here tells us that at least it's about David. And most likely is a psalm written by David. Let's move on to the second S, the situation or the setting. And for that, I will, if you have ability to get to those scriptures in 2 Samuel chapter 15, 16, and 17. Now, if you're not able to get there yet, because you're still a young Christian, so you're not quite familiar with these parts of the scriptures, then don't worry. Hopefully we'll give you enough context so that you'll be able to understand it. In 2 Samuel chapter 15, most probably the setting or the situation which led to the writing of Psalm 23, we see that David is sitting as the anointed king of Israel, anointed by the Lord, anointed by Yahweh in their language. But we see that he has one particular son, and we'll cut into the story at this point. In chapter 15, verses 1 to 12, a son named Absalom, who has aspirations to be the king of Israel. And he has an overweening vanity, an overweening ambition. And you'll see in these first 12 verses of chapter 15, the heart of Absalom as he tries to wheedle his way into the hearts of the people and steal the hearts of the people so that he can take over the throne of Israel. You'll note that there is not one reference to Yahweh in Absalom and his speech. In verse 13, the flashpoint of rebellion is reached. A messenger came and told David, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." Then David said to all his officials who were with him in Jerusalem, "Come, we must flee, or none of us will escape from Absalom. We must leave immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin upon us and put the city to the sword." The king's officials answered him, "Your servants are ready to do whatever our lord the king chooses." And what follows after that is seven scenes as we see David flee from his city, Jerusalem, out into the wilderness to the east. And we'll cut into this third of these seven scenes in verse 30. That David, and we'll see in each of these scenes that there's three things. David is, and use this for your future study, David is located. We see seven different locations. But in each of those, a person approaches David. And there is an encounter between that individual and David. So in this particular third scene, as David is leaving the city, he's climbing up the hill of Mount of Olives on his way out of Jerusalem. And David continued up, in verse 30, the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered, and he was barefoot. And the people with him covered their heads too, and were weeping as they went up. And here we see in the Oriental or the Middle Eastern culture scenes or signs of shame and humiliation and grief in the life of David. He is not proud here. He's in shame. He's in humiliation. He's in grief as he climbs up this hill. And in verse 31, David had been told Ahithophel, one of the counselors, one of his trusted advisors, is among the conspirators with Absalom. And what's David's response? So David prayed, "O Lord, Yahweh, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness." And we see later in the story that that occurred. The fourth scene is at the summit, in verse 32. David arrived at the summit where people used to worship God. He came to the place of worship in his shame, his humiliation, and his grief. And we see there that he meets his friend Hushai, who is the one who is able to bring Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness. Just to touch on one more scene, scene 6, as we go down to chapter 16 and verse 5, a man named Shimei comes along, and he's a man who is a descendant, or he's an enemy of David. And we see that perhaps for hours, David allows him to be cursing him, throwing rocks at him and his men, and throwing dust on him, dirt on him. And so as he's going down the Mount of Olives and out towards the Jordan River, he is subjected to this humiliating treatment by this enemy. And we read in verse 13 of chapter 16 that David and his men continued along the road with Shimei. He was going along the hillside opposite him, cursing as he went, and throwing stones at him and showering him with dirt. This is the king of Israel. This is the anointed one of Yahweh. And the king came, and all the people with him arrived at their destination exhausted. And there he refreshed himself. We then have a bit of the story where the counsel of Ahithophel is given, and Hushai. And we see Ahithophel advising Absalom, wanted in chapter 17. He says, verse 2, "I would attack him while he is exhausted and weak. I would strike him with terror. Then all the people with him will flee. I would strike down only the king and bring all the people back to you. The death of the man you seek," speaking to Absalom, "will mean the return of all. All the people will be unharmed." This plan seemed good to Absalom. So what do we have here as the setting? Well, I just want to go on to one more verse here that we find that David gets across Jordan and he gets to a city called Mahanaim. And we see that as he came to Mahanaim, three men, Shobi the son of Nahash from Rabbah, the Ammonites, historical enemies of Israel, Makur, son of Ammiel from Lodibar, the historical ally of Saul and therefore an enemy of David, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Roglim. Again, an ally of Saul. They brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, sheep and cheese from cow's milk for David and his people to eat. For they said, the people have become hungry and exhausted and thirsty in the desert. And it's from this experience, I would suggest to you, that David writes these wonderful words, the Lord is my shepherd. So just in summary, what do we have here? We have David, Yahweh's anointed king, fleeing from his own capital. We have the mass defection of his people. We have one of his sons, Absalom, who's rebelled against him. We have Shimei, for perhaps hours, cursing him, throwing stones at him, and throwing dirt on his head. We find that he reaches his destination having absolutely no provision. He reaches his destination in absolute exhaustion, not only physically, but emotionally. And we find that he is completely vulnerable to the attack of the enemy who wants to destroy him. He has no provision. He's completely exhausted. And he's vulnerable to the attack of enemies who wish to destroy him. He has lost everything at this point. And yet, the Lord protected him. The Lord refreshed him. And the Lord protected him. So let's go to our third S quickly in structure and go through the psalm. And you'll note that throughout the various messages on psalms, we have attempted to give you literary markers and ways of understanding the structure of a psalm. Last week we had Frank when he was dealing with Psalm 32, and he picked up that word, that Hebrew word salah, which most probably a musical term which means to stop and ponder what we've been talking and singing about, as he put it quite well. Stop and think about it. And that's a literary marker we would look for. There's other things like repetitions of words or phrases. There's the use of pronouns, that I, me, my, or he and his and him. And we see the shifts in those. And we would see them in Psalm 23, given more time. But I would like to focus on the concept of Hebrew poetry. That just for Psalm 23 here. That Hebrew poetry, our poetry, we look for rhyming words often. Meter and rhyming words. But Hebrew poetry is different. It's not so much rhyming sounds as the idea of rhyming ideas. So as we go through these verses, we find these parallels where David makes a point and then he illustrates it with a picture. And in that point and picture parallel, you'll see that he has this rhyming of ideas, so to speak. Let's go through Psalm 23 this way. The first parallel, the first Hebrew couplet, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. That's his point. How does he illustrate it? He makes me lie down in green pastures. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He illustrates with the metaphor of a sheep lying down, not in rough desert ground, but lying down in a pasture where there is no limit to the grass available. And it's of the highest quality. He's put down in a pasture of luxurious wealth. Now remember, he's writing this as a man who has absolutely no provisions left, and he's been provided in absolute dependence in the wilderness with food to eat, as a sheep is provided green pastures by a good shepherd. The second couplet, he leads me beside quiet waters, he restores my soul. We see here the picture is put first, and then the point is made. He leads me beside quiet waters, and as a sheep dried out from a long walk, is put down beside quiet waters to drink cool, refreshing water. It's restored. And so he says, as a sheep, as I, the sheep, am led by my shepherd beside quiet waters, he restores my soul. He refreshes and revives me from my point of exhaustion. The third couplet, Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. That's the point. And we see here that there's a footnote in the NIV. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, even though I walk through a situation where I, as the king, have lost absolutely everything that God has given me. And when we come to the application in our own lives, times of darkest trial, times of utter emotional or physical exhaustion, times where our resources have absolutely been devastated and we have nothing left, times when our health, we're brought to the very brink of death. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. And then the picture, your rod and your staff, the protecting, guiding tools of the shepherd, they comfort me. So you see that we have these couplets where there's a point and a picture, a picture and a point and a picture. And those three couplets deal with the protection of the shepherd, the refreshment of the shepherd, the protection. Did I say provision, refreshment, protection? And now we have a shift where he leaves that metaphor, the picture of the shepherd altogether and the sheep. And we go into verse 5. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. As the enemies were collecting under Absalom to take and to wipe out David, a table was prepared for David by Yahweh. He provided for him. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. These pictures of oriental refreshment and hospitality. His head was anointed with oil by the Lord. My cup overflows. I was totally exhausted, but the Lord refreshed me. And then we see in the last one, surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And again, in the Oriental context, when a person was brought into a home as a guest, they were given all the protection of that house. J.H. Jowett says that Eastern hospitality guarantees the security of their guests. And so again, he says, in the position of absolute bankruptcy, exhaustion and vulnerability, my Lord provided everything that I needed. It's wonderful. Does it work? This is no sappy song about people living in comfortable circumstances who have some cuddly warm feeling about God as their shepherd. This psalm is written from the experience of a man who knew absolute bankruptcy, exhaustion, and vulnerability, and was able to tell of the goodness, the provision, the refreshment, and the protection of a God of love. This is written by a man who was on the edge of his rope, and he could tell us about the faithfulness of our God. I think I'm not going beyond what it says here, but surely goodness and love, and this word love is that word chesed, is the idea of his covenant loyalty to us, his faithfulness, his loving kindness, his mercy. He is everything. He is on our side. He is chesed. Everything that we need, he will provide because he is great. He is loving and he is faithful to his covenant. He will never let his people down. And it's in the context, not Christian. I mean, so many people live in the context. Now I'm starting to preach. Forgive me. The idea that we live our lives as if it ends at death. You cannot read the Psalms. You cannot read the Proverbs from that perspective. This works when we see that life includes death. And it includes resurrection. It includes our whole life in fullness before God. Not only the 70 or 30 or 110 years that we live here on earth, but it includes life beyond the grave, life beyond the sun. It includes our complete, utter life and existence for eternity, now and forever, with a God who loves us. And thus, he's able to say, surely goodness and mercy, surely goodness and chesed shall be with us all the days of our life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord in perpetuity, forever, for length of days. Not only now, but beyond the grave. That shadow of death, I think literally can be the shadow of dying and absolute physical death. And He's still going to have you dwell with him in his house. How does this get applied to us? I believe that we have to answer the question, so what, when we preach? This same God, Yahweh, became a man, and he came to earth in Bethlehem, and we call his name Jesus. And this same Jesus says these words. He says, I am the good shepherd. I lay down my life for my sheep. John chapter 10, verse 11. He provides for us. He restores our souls. He refreshes us. He protects us in all kinds of circumstances of life and death and resurrection. And he says, my sheep hear my voice. I know them, and they follow me, and I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish. Neither shall anyone be able to pluck them or snatch them out of my hand. And he says words like this, that he built his church upon the rock, not Peter, upon himself, Jesus Christ, or upon the confession that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And he says the gates of Hades shall never, never, never prevail against it. Absolute, ironclad guarantee to security. So, as David, from that experience of bankruptcy and exhaustion and vulnerability, can write such a wonderful psalm and say, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That same psalm can be taken upon our hearts and our lips and sung to speak about our experiences if we are people of God. He is everything. He, in our times of absolute bankruptcy, is able to provide all that we need to enjoy fullness of life. When we are emotionally and spiritually and mentally and physically exhausted, he is able to provide us with the refreshment and resources to live life with him to the fullest. And when we are vulnerable to the attacks of our enemy, which is ultimately Satan, he is there to protect us so that we are absolutely secure in his hand. What a wonderful God we have. What a wonderful shepherd we have. And as the people in the first temple would stand and sing this wonderful psalm, thinking of their own experiences, they would sing this psalm as if it was their psalm. They would sing this as if it was their song. Well, we have 5 minutes left to sing 366. The Lord is my shepherd. And as we sing that, just take a moment to ponder it and to make it your song, my song, as we sing together this wonderful song, The Lord is my shepherd.